Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking about pipelining. First, a brief logistical note. So exams are graded if you didn't notice. A lot of people want to know what the average is. The average is around an 86, which is like a little higher than last semester when it was around an 83 for the first midterm. Don't know whether that means we made it easier or done better. Probably a little, ended up a little higher than we were expected, but okay. So that's about the exam. Any questions about the midterm? Anything on it? Grading? Yeah.
You know, like, there's a pretty big grade difference between like the first class and the second class?
I did not check this.
Oh.
The only thing I looked at is whether there's a pretty big grade difference between the variants.
Yeah.
And basically not. Which is good. You'd be disturbed if there was. Yeah.
Will we be getting our exams back?
They're on TPEX. So if you go to TPEX, that's the SFNU.edu. You should have a copy of your exam. There was a bug which meant some people's wasn't displaying. That is now fixed. So you should all be able to see them. And that's where you submit regrades. If you have any, you will eventually look at those. And we don't want to get the regrades at the end of the semester. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Wait, how can you get a regrade on a multiple choice test?
They're graded by humans, and humans make mistakes. So yes, your regrade should be very straightforward. Like, I put down C, and the key says B, C, and you marked it wrong. They should not be things where we have to to think about the question, unless you think the key is actually wrong, in which case you should talk to us. It's not impossible that the key is wrong or that a question is ambiguous, but you know, hopefully we found all those problems. Okay, other inquiries about the exam? Okay, so in that case, we'll move on to talking about pipelining. So last time, we talked about our solution for hazards. Hazards were things that our pipeline did, which, unless we resolve them, would cause us to get the wrong answer. And one example was this data hazard, where we were looking for a value in a register, but we write an older version of it. And our easiest solution to this was stalling. And I'd like to talk a little about how we actually are going to implement this stall. And next, after spring break, we'll talk more about the actual logic of implementing this, but just give a preview of that. I suggest that this is not sort of just magic. So here, during the stall, we fetch the new add instruction. So our PC is 2, and we don't do anything with it. We make a decision not to do anything, and to send on for the next cycle, to set the PC to 2 again, we leave it the same, and we pass in these do nothing values and no op values to the next stage. And those values just flow through normally like a normal instruction. So to do this, we've added two sort of pieces of logic. So one thing we added is basically a mux in front of all the pipeline registers. So in front of the PC here, which we wanted to keep the same, we added this mux where we can choose between our normal incremented value, like the one you constructed in the lab, and keeping the same value, where we just wired it back around. And we have some control signal where we figured out whether we should stall. So we have some logic which looks at something and figures out whether we should stall, and determines which input to this mux we use. And we do the same sort of thing for deciding whether to pass on a no-op or not. So in front of our RA register between fetch and decode, normally we're going to put the actual thing we got from the instruction, the register A field. But sometimes we want to pass on a no-op. So we have a mux where one of the inputs is the no-op register, which is reg-none, that's the register 15, the one the register file never does anything with. So sometimes we're going to pass that register number, and sometimes we're going to pass the one we actually got from the instruction. And again, we have some control logic, which is going to make a decision based on something to decide which of these to do. So while we're waiting for the add to be ready to run, we're going to set this stall signal to true, so to keep the PC where it is, because we can't finish this add instruction yet, and set this bubble signal. This is called, we're going to call this a bubble. It's going to be like air we're inserting in the pipe. The no operations are air. And we're going to set that to true, so when the next stage does something, it's not doing anything that interferes with anything. So these two muxes are sort of our basic construction for how we're going to implement that stalling we saw earlier, and also some other things we're going to do with our pipeline we'll talk. And we'll talk in more detail about how, the mechanics of like doing this in HCLTD and all that on Tuesday after spring break. But a note is that these two control signals we have, this stall and this bubble, are provided for you by HCLTD. So when you look at HCLTD, they're going to provide you these muxes already. They're built for you for every single register bank. And this is the big reason why we're writing these register bank things in HCLTD, not just each register individually. This is why HCLTD gives you that interface. So by having these registers together, you can have, there's going to be one signal you can set to have them all keep the same value, one signal you can set to have them all use no-op values, which HCLTD is going to use the default value, so that better be a no-op value if you want to use this feature. And this will save you from writing out the equivalent of these muxes manually, which you could do, but probably you don't want to, especially because you're going to have RA and RB and so on, and it would be really painful to write all the code to optionally set each of them to the default value and then maybe realize you forgot one somewhere and then your processor behaves funny. So next time we'll talk more about when we set these, but these are our two central mechanisms. That we have this stall control signal so we can say, oh, the PC is 2, I want to keep it at 2, even though I have this this input I computed that would be the next PC, because I can't actually move on to the next instruction. And hey, I read I read 9 and 8 for RA and RB, but ignore that. Instead, just put in the no-op values. So we have a control signal to do that. And these are sort of what we're going to be doing during this stall. So any questions about this sort of concept of bubble and stall? So, as I said, on Tuesday, we'll talk about exactly how we apply this to all the ways we're going to be dealing with hazards, which will be stalling and an additional thing we'll learn about in this class. Okay. So with that, let's move on to going from having our sort of toy processor that just does ads be pipelined to actually pipelining our full single cycle processor. And the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to start with the picture we saw of our single cycle processor. I'm just going to mark out which region is which stage. So we have our fetch stage, our decode stage, execute, memory, and write back. And just like we do with the add processor, I want to have everything for an instruction go from one stage to the next. So I don't want something that skips from fetch to write back. So I'm going to redraw this in a way where that doesn't happen to avoid that. And we have another case where we go from fetch to memory. This is for call instructions. We need to send the address of the next instruction to store on the stack. So you have something which skips from fetch to memory. And again, I'm going to want that to actually go through every stage in between. And we also have something which goes from memory to fetch. This is in the case of our RET instruction. And this is going to be more problematic. We'll talk about how we deal with this in a bit. So I'm going to redraw this by omitting most of the junk. So not junk really, but like I'm not going to draw out the ALU and all the muxes. I'm going to just draw out the sort of general flow of things without showing every connection exactly to keep things simpler so we can talk about how we pipeline it. So here's the drawing I'm starting with. I've just drawn this big box labeled logic for all those muxes and ALUs and things like that, just to make things less cluttered. So somewhere in here is the ALU and the muxes. Somewhere here is the muxes for choosing what the actual registers are, whether they're RSP and so on. And I've drawn this in a way where I only have connections from one stage to the next. So the assumption is that, yeah, we're going to have to pass a value from fetch to the data memory for call, and that's going to be done through here, then here, then here. And you know, we're just drawing it in a way where we don't have anything which skips stages, that everything goes cleanly across the line with no skipping, no exceptions. So once I've done this, once I just rearranged the picture this way, which I could have done without removing any lines, but it would be way too cluttered to ever reason about, I'm going to follow our basic procedure for making something pipelined, which is I figure out where the stages are, and I draw lines between them, and I put registers for everything that crosses that line. So there we go. Registers, I just draw lines between the stages, and I have a set of pipeline registers for everything that crosses those lines. So that's our basic procedure. So you figure out everything that goes from one stage to the next, and those are going to be in registers. And we have the one little weird case that we haven't dealt with correctly, which is this connection to the program counter. And that's not something we're supposed to do. What we want to happen is what happens for typical instructions is that we look at the PC, we do some logic with the value from the instruction memory, and compute the next PC. But that's not actually what we're showing here. And there's nothing that keeps us from having a processor that works correctly by doing this. It's just not going to be very fast. So if we waited until after the memory stage to be able to update our PC, if that was our procedure, then if we're running sub then add, we do sub, and we need to wait for 3 cycles in order to figure out what the next instruction to fetch was. That's clearly not what we want. It's clearly not going to give us any benefits from pipelining. So we're going to want to do better. So what we're going to do is we're going to handle most of the time, we're going to do everything in the fetch stage, like we talked about, combining fetch and PC update. But we're not always going to be able to do that. So some of the time, we actually need to at least wait until we get through the memory to do our computation, find our next instruction. So except for our two special cases, our conditional jumps and our returns, we're going to always do everything in the fetch stage. But for the other cases, we're going to need to do something else. And for returns, that means we're going to need to stall for a while. And that's okay. So this gives us sort of a revised picture of our stages. So one thing is that, so our fetch stage is where we do fetch and PC update, as I said last time. So we're doing the instruction memory access, and we're doing most of the program counter computation. But there's some cases, notably RET, where we can't do the program counter computation in fetch. So in those cases, we'll have to delay it for later. And in order to delay it, we're going to need to do something like stalling. In the code, we read the register file as usual. In execute, we're going to read and write condition codes. So writing condition codes in execute makes sense, because that's when we do the computation that gives us what the condition code should become. So clearly, we can't write it sooner than that. So the reason we're reading is because this is going to avoid data hazards. If we read, tried to read before execute, then it might be the case that we haven't run the thing that sets the condition codes yet. So if we're running a conditional move or a jump, conditional jump, and we try to read the condition codes in fetch, then the instruction that's going to set the condition codes is only in decode. It hasn't changed them yet. So we'll read the wrong value. We also can't read them later. So it's tempting to say, well, for a conditional move, shouldn't we just read the condition codes and write back? Because that's when we need them, when we decide what we're going to write. But that's not good either. Because if we're in write back, then the instruction after us has already set the condition codes. So we might be reading a later version of the condition codes than the one we're supposed to be using. So that's not acceptable either. But by reading them in the same stage where they're written, we avoid all those data hazards. We're always reading them right after the last instruction that could have written them is run, and not after more instructions may have run. So the other notable thing is that our writeback writes to the register file. This is also where we're going to update the stat register. So we have to update the stat register in this stage. So why? What's going to go wrong if we try to update it earlier? So like in your lab this week, you updated the stat register at the same time you updated the PC. Why can't we do that? What's going to go wrong if we do that? Yeah.
I mean, it says it on there, but like if you set the stat to halt or something like that, it'll stop before you finish whatever the current instruction is.
Yeah. So if we just set the stat register and fetch, our halt instruction would take effect basically four instructions before you wrote it. It's not what we want. We want to let the if we have a write to memory followed by a halt, we expect that write to memory to actually happen, which is why we have to write the stat register in write back. This is about avoiding a hazard again. So any questions about either of these sort of things we've added to these stages? Okay, so these are our revised stages. And I've talked about adding pipeline registers. And we're going to have a naming convention for these pipeline registers, which is the one that's used by our books, the one you will most likely be using in HCL2D, though we don't grade you on using them. And it's a little weird, so I'm going to talk about it. So in HCL2D, our register banks are named with two letters. This is based on what our textbook does. So there's a lowercase letter for the inputs and an uppercase letter for the outputs. And the convention our textbook uses is that we name the registers around a stage like fetch using the letter of the stage. So the inputs and outputs have the letter of the stage. So outputs into the fetch stage have a capital F. So capital F underscore PC means something for the fetch stage called PC. And lowercase f underscore PC means something to give to the next fetch stage in the next cycle. Something being given by the fetch stage to the next cycle called PC. So a good example here is in the decode stage. We have an input called d underscore RA. That's the thing that the code stage has got that's called RA. And it came from f underscore RA, the thing that the fetch stage output, which is called RA. So in HCL2D, this register bank is labeled register lowercase f capital D. And this means that everything that a code stage is touching starts with a D. So the capital D is the inputs, the lowercase d is the outputs, which are going to go to the execute stage. So the decode stage reads DRB and uses it to set D-D. In this example. And generally, the pattern you'll be following when you implement your processor is that everything you do when you implement a stage is going to deal with things which are prefixed by the letter that identifies the stage. So F for fetch, D for decode, E for execute, and so on. And if you aren't doing that, you should be suspicious that, am I really doing the right thing? Okay, so any questions on this convention? Okay, so with that convention in mind, let's look at how we actually deal with the trickiest case, which is our PC update. So I said we're doing most PC computation in the fetch stage, and you're pretty familiar with how that looks. So you did that in this week's lab. So we have get some value, we have something which comes based on the I code that chooses what to add to it. So this is our most common PC update case. You implemented it, hopefully most of you were successful. You know, it's fairly straightforward. So this is an example of control logic that we had. We did something based on an instruction. And the typical form you've seen for implementing our sort of single cycle designs is that whenever you have a control decision to make, you have this sort of thing in a MUX where you look at the I code and you make a decision. And maybe you look at some other things from the instruction. And we need to apply that elsewhere in our processor. So we haven't gotten that far, this far in the single cycle assignments, but one thing you're going to eventually need to do is implement memory instructions in our single cycle processor. And conceptually, there's, you know, what we do is we look at the I code and we decide what to tell the data memory to do. And one of the things we have to say is, do we want to read? Do we want to write? So the way I do this in our single cycle processors, I look at the I code. I say, is it a read? Well, if it is, I'm going to set the read signal to true. Is it an instruction that writes? If so, I'm going to set the write signal to true. So can I just do this? So is this the right picture for our pipeline processor? Do I just use the same stuff? So does that someone want to explain why I might not? Yeah.
Maybe you don't want to
read
or write.
Maybe I don't what?
You don't want to read or write.
Okay, well, so this is read or is write. So the answer is maybe I don't want to read or write. This is read presumably will can output zero at the same time that is write can output zero. If the I code is something like add. Yeah.
You still have to go through all, you haven't gone through all the steps or like propagated the code, like the I code through all the other previous stages?
Yeah, so this picture says the I code from the instruction memory. That's not the I code of the thing which is currently in the memory stage. When we've, when we're executing this instruction, what's gonna be instruction at PC2, something else is going to be at the memory stage. So we need to do something different. So we're in fact going to be getting our I code from a pipeline register. And we're going to follow this rule that, you know, that everything we're using comes from the previous stage or something in our stage, like the memory, in the memory stage. So we're going to read this from a pipeline register, and since it's a pipeline register we use for our instruction, and we're in the memory stage, it must have come from the execute stage. So this means now that the execute stage needs to know what the I code is. And in order to know that, it had to get it from the decode stage. And the decode stage, well, it couldn't figure it out directly, so it had to get it from the fetch stage. So it came from the instruction memory, but we had this indirection. And we needed this because we want the I code for the same instruction that this data input and address are going to belong to, not for whatever instructions currently being fetched. And the way we're going to keep things consistent is by getting the I code from the same register bank we get the operands for the data input and the address. So we're going to start out with code like this, sets memory bit, you know, if it's a move from memory or not, and so on. You're going to not want to do that. We're going to, in fact, not want to use iCode, which comes from i10 bytes. We're going to want to use something which comes from i10 bytes, then goes to a register, and then in a later cycle goes to another register and another register. So our basic code structure is going to be that we're going to set up a register bank, one for between each of the stages. So this is between fetch and decode. We're going to have one between decode and execute, execute in memory and write back. And following our naming convention, the one that starts in fetch and goes to the code is named FD, lowercase f, capital D. And we're going to set the input to this based from the instruction memory in fetch. And then we're going to get the output and pass it on to the next stage in decode. So we're going to copy it from big D, the input to the decode stage, to little d, the output of the decode stage, that goes to the execute stage, and so on. And eventually, it's going to end up in big M I code, which is our input for our memory stage, and this is what we're actually going to use to figure out whether or not we read or write. So any questions about this structure here? So in general, something we're going to do is we're always going to be passing the I code, at least, in our pipeline registers.
because there's places everywhere where we're making decisions based on the iCode. And this is even though we've never actually drawn that when we drew our single cycle processor. But we have all this undrawn control logic which needs to use the iCode. And in our single cycle processor, we just got it from the instruction memory. We just sent off a wire to the instruction memory to get it. That's not going to cut it in our pipeline processor because we'd be getting it from the wrong instruction. And so this is used in pretty much every stage. In the code, we need it to figure out whether we use the register number from the instruction or something else. In execute, we need to figure out the ALU operation and whether we use an ALU input from the instruction or from something else. And we also need it to implement things like stalling. So there's a general rule I'd like to impress upon you for coding pipeline stages and for things that you could do wrong when coding pipeline stages. So generally, when you're writing the code in HCL2D to implement, say, the execute stage, the rule you should follow is that you should be using only outputs from the prior stages as your inputs. You should not be peeking at other values. So if it's not in your stage and it's not some component that's part of your stage, like if you're in memory, the data memory is part of your stage, and it's not from the prior stage, and you're using it, you probably did something wrong. And you should only set inputs for the next stage. So if you're in decode, you have stuff you got from fetch, which is labeled with capital D, and you have stuff you're sending to execute, which is labeled with lowercase d. And that's what you should be working with, besides the component that's part of your stage, which is the register file read inputs and outputs. So there are two notable exceptions, and these are the cases where people usually have the most bugs when they try to implement pipeline processors. So one is figuring out what instruction to run next. This is a case where we better be talking to a stage responsible for a different instruction. Because we need to want to run a different instruction next, probably. And when we're dealing with data and control hazards, to implement stalling and things like that, other techniques we'll learn about, we're going to need to talk between stages because this is all about how multiple instructions interact. So in these cases, we're going to need to interact, and these are where the most common sort of bugs in implementing pipelining come up. And these are notoriously difficult to debug because they're typically cases where you say, okay, my add instruction's not computing the right value. And you like try to reason about it by thinking about, well, what does the add instruction do? Like, do I have the right inputs to the ALU and so on? But what's actually happening is your add instruction sometimes doesn't compute the right value because it's actually looking at partly the add instruction and partly some other instruction that you didn't think was involved. So these are our guides for coding pipeline stages. So one thing we need to figure out is what are these inputs and outputs going to be? And we can do this systematically. And this is a case where our book's logical division into stages that we talked about and that our book shows you for how we run an instruction stage by stage is going to be helpful. So let's look at the description the book has for push queue. So our book gives a description of push queue into fetch, decode, execute memory, write back, and PC update. I've moved PC update up because we know that usually happens with fetch. And we can look at this and figure out, well, what exactly do we need to put in pipeline registers based on looking at what values are used and saying, where did that have to come from? So you can say, oh, I'm using array here. And wow, that is very thin here. I'm using array here, and that means that I better get array from the instruction memory, so it better be in the pipeline registers between here and where it came, between fetch and decode. Similarly, I can say, okay, I'm computing val A and val B in decode, and then I'm using val B in execute and val A in memory. So val A, I need in all the pipeline registers between decode and memory. So I need a val A between decode and execute, and between execute and memory. And for val B, I can say, oh, I need it from decode to execute. So, and finally, I can look at val D and say, okay, I compute something called val D in execute, and I need it later in memory, so it must be in the pipeline register in between. Because we follow these rules that everything comes from the pipeline registers, we can use this to systematically figure out everything that must be in the pipeline register. So I just did this for push,
but we just go through all our instructions to do this. So, and we can similarly do this for, say, add queue. We say, okay, I'm using RB, and RB. So I need RA from between fetch and decode. And I'm using RB in write back, which means, and it comes from fetch. So that means every single pipeline register between fetch and write back needs to have a copy of RB, even though there's nothing I'm doing with it in memory or execute. Still needs to be passed all the way through. And similarly, I can look at, I say, I have val A and val B, and I need in decode, and I need them in execute, so they must be passed between decode and execute. And I can do the same with val E. So val E is not used in memory, it's used in writeback. And I say, okay, I'm setting val E in execute, using it in writeback, so everything between execute and writeback must have a copy of it in its pipeline registers. So we just do this procedure for absolutely every instruction, and that's how we figure out what's in the pipeline registers. So one way you can do this when creating HCL2D is you implement one instruction, then you add another instruction, and the first step is you add to the pipeline registers as you need to by looking at this sort of chart for that instruction. So one note is that our book doesn't quite do this set up for the pipeline registers. So our book, instead of passing RB through to write back, computes something it calls DestD into code, and then passes that through to write back. So they could have passed RB through. That would have been perfectly valid, but they decided that it was easier to pass this, to compute this DestD and pass it through. And the main advantage of that is that it's going to make handling data hazards easier. It's going to be easier to figure out what an instruction is doing without looking at the iCode. So we could have used RB in iCode and been happy with that, but having DestD is going to end up making things easier later. So that's why our book decided to do that. But it would have been perfectly valid, and we're not even won't even take off if you implement things by passing RB, but DestD will be easier, just because it's easier to go and write back and just be able to look up what we're writing to, and it turns out we're going to want that information in other places besides write back. When we handle hazards and implement things like stalling. So any questions on this procedure for figuring out what's in pipeline registers? Okay, so seems clear enough. So now let's return to dealing with the PC. This is our trickiest issue. And we have sort of three cases. So we have the easy case. You know, the things we're doing in the fetch stage that you've implemented in lab already. And that's the same code you can use for every assignment we have that sets the PC for anything but return and jumps. So then we have our rect, which as we said, we need to wait till the memory stage. You might think, hey, I could be smart and I can take a shortcut. So if no one's using the memory right now, I can just use the memory and read the place to return to. You know, that would save a lot of time, wouldn't it? Why are we stalling all these instructions? But we can't do that in general, clearly, because in the worst case, it could be the case that the instruction right before the ret is the thing that writes to the data memory the thing we're about to read to return to. The case where this actually happens is if we call a function which consists of just a return. In that case, to return correctly, we need to read the thing that was just written to memory. So we're not going to be able to do that. We actually have to wait till the memory stage. There's no way around it. So even if we could somehow shortcut and like if the current instruction's not using the memory, use it. We can't actually do that and have the correct result. So the other case is our conditional jump. And as I mentioned earlier, we're going to read and write condition codes in the execute stage. This makes sure we have the right version of the condition codes, but it means our conditional jumps are going to actually need to wait until the execute stage. So this is a bit annoying for performance, because the natural thing is that this means our conditional jump is going to have to stall.
So our natural implementation is that, say, we have a subtract and then a conditional jump. We need to wait for that subtract to get to execute. And then the cycle after that, we can actually figure out what to do. So the way we'll implement this is we'll send the conditional jump through the pipeline as usual. And even though our usual way of writing the instruction wouldn't do anything in any of the pipeline stages, we'll actually do our useful work in the execute stage. So we'll send it into the pipeline. It will go into decode, do nothing, go to execute, and then it will do something. It will read the condition codes. In this case, the condition codes that were just set by the previous instruction. So it reads the condition codes, figures out what the actual address of the jump should go to is, and sends the signal about, hey, was this jump taken or not, to the fetch stage. And then the fetch stage knows, OK, what instruction do I fetch next? And the crux of doing this is that we had to wait two segments in fetch and send two bubbles down the pipeline. So there's two cycles where we weren't doing useful work in fetch and later on and down every single stage of the pipeline because fetch didn't have anything to send. It just sent a no op. So one thing we need to do to implement this is we need to actually implement the program counter update that handles this. So what's that going to look like? What are we going to do to handle this update here? What do we need to add? So previously, this is what our program counter update looked like. What do we need to add to this? What's missing? So remember, so we're doing two things. So one thing is that we're stalling. So, and the other thing is that after we're done stalling, we're somehow either using the address of a jump or the address of the next program counter. So what are we going to add to represent making a decision like this? A mux. So we're going to need to add a mux. So we're going to have a mux decide, are we stalling? Are we using the jump target, or are we doing something else? And the tricky part is not this mux, actually. It's what the heck does this logic do, and where does it get its signals from? So one of the signals we know of is that we get this taken signal that somehow our execute stage tells us, oh, OK, this jump was, I looked at the condition codes, and I decided the jump was taken or not. And we also need to somehow decide whether we're stalling or not. But it's not actually, you know, completely obvious how to write that. We'll talk a bit about how that's constructed later. So this is probably the simplest idea. It's just add a mux in front of the PC. This is not what our textbook has chosen to do. So our textbook does something which I think is a little weird. And they just to split up things differently. So here, after we fetch from the PC register the actual instruction we want to run, and then we do the entire computation at the end of the cycle of the next instruction to run. Something else we could have done is we could have done the computation at the beginning of the cycle. We could have fetched the last instruction we ran and then did the computation based on that. And our textbook does a mix of the two. So our textbook decides to take this mux and move it after here. So they do that transformation. So instead of storing the PC, we store sort of the PC, the incremented PC, and later on, at the beginning of the cycle, just before we access the instruction memory, we fix up that based on handling stalls and jumps, or handling jumps. We probably handle stalls here, unsure. So we do our jump fix up later. But it's the same idea as adding the mux earlier. You could have implemented adding the mux earlier. Our textbook just doesn't do that. But conceptually, at the very beginning of the cycle, we're looking at our computed, incremented PC, and possibly the jump target, and deciding which one to use, instead of doing it at the end of the previous cycle. So any questions about this sort of transformation? I know it's reasonably confusing. So our textbook calls this the predicted PC. So their idea is that we're guessing what the PC will be, and if we're wrong, we'll fix it. We're doing something like this. It doesn't actually quite look like this, and we'll talk about how jumps are handled doesn't quite look like this. We'll talk about how that actually works later. So we're going to have some control logic here, which decides which of these to do. And this is something you can implement in HCL2D, where we're going to somehow get this jump target and some information about whether things are taken. So where do we get the jump target from? Where can that come from? Yeah. So this is what we call a val C. So that ultimately came from the instruction memory. So can we get it from the instruction memory? So why not?
Because it has to go through the write-back phase first before toggling it, right?
So it has to go through the write-back phase. So it doesn't. So.
Or it has to go through the whatever mux logic we have for that phase, right?
Okay, so it has to go through, you can say it has to go through like some between stages. Yeah, so in this case, the jump target is not computed in at the beginning of the fetch stage before we access the instruction memory. So even though it came from the instruction memory, we can't be getting it here as input to the instruction memory. That would be a loop. Who knows what the address in the instruction memory would be? That doesn't work. So it must come from some sort of register where we store what we read from the instruction memory previously. The easiest thing to do is just like we pass the I code down with a jump instruction, we can also pass the jump target and get it from the same place we get the taken flag. So ultimately, we're going to implement something like this in HCL2D. We're going to compute the PC we actually want to pass to the instruction memory, which I've just defined a wire somewhere. And if the condition code said that the branch was taken, we're going to make a jump target. Otherwise, we're going to send the value through from our register. This is conceptually basically what we're implementing. It turns out we'll be doing something a little different, but this is the simple solution with that style, with that mux after that predicted PC register. So I showed you, talked about where the jump target would come from. So we get it from the instruction memory, put it in a pipeline register, and then read from that pipeline register in a different instruction, but that's okay, because this is about figuring out what instruction to run next. It's one of the cases where we're allowed to do that. What about taken? What does the logic for figuring out whether the branch is taken look like? So that happens in execute, and the basic form is going to be that we read the ifunc, and we have a bunch of choices based on the ifunc. Sometimes we always take the branch. Sometimes we look at whether ZF is true. Sometimes we look whether ZF or SF is true, and so on. So we just have this big mux where we look at all the where we look at the condition codes and figure out which combination of condition codes we want. And we get this value, which is 0 or 1. And because we need it at the beginning of the cycle, before we access the instruction memory, we're going to just put that in the register. In particular, this is going to be one of the pipeline registers, conceptually, that are between execute and memory. So for that jump instruction, which is in execute, it's going to compute this branch taken and put it in the pipeline registers. And we can actually just read from that later on. So this takes care of where we get the taken value. So the taken value is going to be in this register. So we can just name its output, which is going to be something like big M underscore branch taken, big M because it's the input to the memory stage of the jump instruction that just finishes to execute. So the remaining thing we need to do is figure out when we need to stall and when we actually are going to have this value versus when we're computing whether a branch was taken, but it's not actually a branch instruction, right? Because something's going to be in this register, regardless of what type of instruction it is. Because this circuit doesn't say, hey, if it's not a branch instruction, don't compute anything. We can't do that. So something's in this register, and we only want to use it if we're actually running a jump. So how can we figure that out? How do I know that I'm here, and I'm ready to fetch IR move queue in cycle 5 versus cycle 4, where I can't do that? So the question is going to be about looking at what's in the pipeline. So our central idea for knowing if we're ready is that we're ready to start the next instruction if the jump made it to the memory phase. So if we got past the execute where we read the condition code. So how can I tell whether that's true? What information exists that would tell me that? Or what could I add? What would I keep track of to do that? Yeah.
When the jump command had happened earlier.
Okay, so one thing we could do is we could set a counter here, and like say, when was my last jump? And I could keep track of that and say, okay, when did I increment the counter? And when it reaches a certain value, do that. So that would be a valid option, but there's in fact something simpler we can do. So an observation to make is here, my iCode input to the fetch registers between fetch and decode is JXX. And here, from in my decode stage, when I'm looking at the iCode there, that iCode output, it's JXX. And a big thing we're going to do over and over again is when we want to know what's happening in our pipeline, we're going to read the pipeline registers to figure out what's happening. And what basically, we're asking a question here of, is a jump instruction in its memory stage? And the easiest answer to that is going to be, let's look at MIcode. What's running in the memory stage right now? Is it jump? So this means our logic ends up being something like this. If the memory stage has a jump instruction, and that what that jump instruction just computed and executed says the branch was taken, then go to the jump target, otherwise go to the predicted PC. If we're also in a jump instruction. And we're going to reuse this trick over and over again of look at what the pipeline registers are to figure out what instruction is where. And this is how we're going to decide when to stall. We know that we need to stall here because, oh, there's a jump instruction in decode, so I must not be ready yet to run the next instruction. That's how we know when to stall. And here, there's a jump instruction in execute, so I'm not ready yet to know what instruction to run next. And we'll use this again with other techniques we're going to have for handling data hazards and control hazards. Okay. So that's sort of handling jump with stalls. The other thing we have to handle with stalls is RET. And as I mentioned, RET, we have to wait till the memory phase because this could happen, where we call and immediately return. And you might say, okay, so the return address is stored here. What stops us from just executing, why can't we just execute the thing right away? This is the worst case, so you could special case this, and maybe for other cases, we could just read. We could special case this and do that, but we're not going to want to special case things. The other thing you might say is, well, we read it here. Why can't we start the instruction right away that we return to? Because we know the return address in step 5, why can't we just start it? So what's the reason we don't do this? We could, actually. We could add this wire here from the output of the data memory and not go through this register and just start the instruction right away. So why don't we do that? So this is a correct thing to do, but it has very bad performance. So what's the reason for the bad performance? So how do we know how fast our pipeline processor is? Yeah.
It's as fast as the slowest thing,
the critical path, we call it. And that's precisely what the problem with doing this is. So it is correct to just take the value from the data memory, feed it through some logic, which was going to say, oh, I'm executing a return, and I just finished reading, and I'm reading the memory now. So I can put that memory value in the instruction memory to figure out what instruction to fetch. But the problem is that this is our critical path if we do this. And memories are one of our slowest components. So we've probably made this processor basically twice as slow by doing this, which is not worth saving a cycle on every return. Even if we have lots and lots of returns, we don't have that many. You know, it might be worth it if our programs were all returns, but they probably aren't. They're probably at least 50% not returns. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to put the value in our pipeline register and read it from there. Or alternately, we could have read it directly from the data memory into the PC. Either of them is equivalent. But we're going to wait until the end of the cycle for the memory read to finish, just so we don't have to worry about adding to our critical path accessing both memories. We're only going to access one to keep our cycle time short. It's not that it would be wrong. As far as correctness goes, it would just be bad performance. Okay. So return. We're going to wait until the return instruction enters the write-back phase. And during that write-back phase of the return instruction, that's when we can fetch the new instruction and start running it. Fetch the following instruction. Up till then, we have to stall. Okay. So this is the most straightforward way of handling our two what are called control hazards, the cases where we couldn't just figure out the PC in the fetch stage. We had a control hazard because the natural thing our pipeline did didn't let us figure out the PC when we wanted it. Didn't let us fetch an instruction every cycle. It turns out we can do better, and we will do better. And we'll start with this observation about when do instructions change things. So nothing actually changes in our processor during the fetch stage. We read the instruction memory. And we write some pipeline registers, but nothing permanent, none of the user-visible state changes. The same is true during decode. None of the user-visible state of the processor changes. In execute, our condition codes change. And this is something that we can observe in other instructions because you could have a conditional move, for example. In memory, our memory writes happen, so that changes the state of the memory, so it changes stuff the user sees. And right back, we have our changes to actual registers and stack. So this is going to give us a neat trick, which is that we can undo instructions as long as they haven't finished execute. So if an instruction got to decode, we can just forget about it. So if we get rid of it from our pipeline registers, it's gone. It didn't do anything. Even if an instruction's in execute, as long as we don't let it finish it right to the condition codes that cycle, we can forget about it, and it's gone. It didn't do anything. This would be harder if the instruction got to write back or memory, because it might have changed some stuff by the time we want to forget about it. We'd have to undo the things it did, which would be a lot more complicated. But up until then, we can actually undo the instruction. And this means we can execute instructions speculatively. We can guess about what instruction should run. And so what we're going to do is we're going to actually make a guess. We're going to run some instruction that might be the instruction we want to run. It might not. And as long as we don't get finish execute, the way we fix our guess, the way we correct the mistake we might have made, is we get rid of any condition code update that's about to happen. We just have a mock switch which says, oh, was I not supposed to do this? If so, don't change the condition codes. And we just forget everything that was in pipeline registers. We just used to do the bubble thing and output no ops from the pipeline registers instead of what we actually had stored, or were going to have stored. And this is something we're going to use for conditional jumps. So in this jump here, what we can do is we can make a guess. And for reasons I'll talk about later, our guess is going to be that we'll go to the label. So if we make a guess, instead of stalling, we'll make the guess, start executing add queue and RM move queue. And after we fetch RM move queue, that's when the execute for the jump is going to happen. And in the next cycle, we will learn whether our guess was right. And if our guess was right, we don't have to do anything. We did the right thing, and if we just let things go through the pipeline as usual, we'll keep executing the right instructions. If our guess was wrong, well, we just need to forget about this add queue instruction. We just need to remove it from the pipeline registers between decode and execute and between execute and memory, and make sure it doesn't change the condition codes. And then, to fix our guess, we just start executing the right instruction, this XOR. And because we forgot about the instructions that we weren't supposed to execute, this XOR will see things as if nothing else happened. The same effect as if we actually did stall. So this is strictly better. We're two cycles faster when we're right, and we're actually no slower when we're wrong. So the idea is that when we make a right guess, we start the add, and we don't know whether that's right, but it's fine because we haven't gotten to our danger point. And we start the RM move queue. And we're doing this instead of cases where we're just doing nothing. So we're filling the pipeline instead of with doing nothing with and waiting with actual work. And later on, we finish this jump here, and this jump is done, and then we learn, okay, yep, you were actually supposed to be running the add queue here, so you're fine, and we do nothing more. So this is our correct case. So we have these things which we're just guessing, and if our guess turns out right, we just don't do anything, we just confirm our guess, and we're done. In the case where our guess is wrong, we need to get rid of our guesses. So we finish our jump, we find out, oh, you weren't supposed to go there. And we just need to, instead of passing the RM move queue instruction from fetch to decode, and the add queue instruction from decode to execute, we need to replace what we're doing with doing nothing. We need to suppress what was there. So we somehow squash, this is the actual term of art, the wrong guesses, and replace them with no ops. So as if we had stalled. And then we start executing the thing that we would have executed anyway if we stopped. So we look up what the correct next instruction was, which we probably learned from a pipeline register and jump. That's the easiest way to keep track of it. We could keep track of it in some other way. And we just look it up and start running it as if we were running no ops here. Because we turn them into no ops by forgetting about everything that we're doing. So any questions about this procedure here? This is called branch prediction. Usually not considered an easy thing to understand. Okay. So in our processor we'll be implementing, we will be using branch prediction. And it turns out that it actually probably simplifies our processor, which doesn't seem intuitive because it seems like squashing instructions is extra work. But we've just gotten rid of all the stalling logic, and we just need to do squashing instead. And the squashing is fairly simple because the only weird thing we need to do is make sure we don't accidentally write to condition codes. Everything else is very straightforward. It's just manipulating pipeline register outputs to be nops, which we need to do and know how to do anyway for other reasons. So there's some extra logic to squash mispredicted instructions, but in exchange, we actually aren't doing any stalling on conditional jumps. And we don't have to implement all that logic to do stalling. And the way we'll be doing prediction is we'll be predicting branches as taken. And this is actually an informed choice, not just done because it happens to be easier, but it is, even though it is easier. So why would we want to predict branches as taken? Well, people have studied this. So people have looked at lots and lots of programs and looked at every single branch in every single in those programs, executing, you know, some benchmark. And there's an empirical observation that most jumps, most conditional jumps, are taken. And this seems, well, why does that happen? And if you want an intuition for why this happened, which may or may not be what really happened, it's hard to like study the sort of causes of this in detail, a good possible reason is loops. So this is our typical form of a loop. We have a branch that goes to the beginning of the loop. Most of the time, we execute the loop more than once. So this branch is taken more than half the time. If this loop has 100 iterations, it's taken 99% of the time. So this happens often enough. This is one intuition for why predicting branches is taken would usually be right. And I think the empirical numbers are that like 60 or 70% of branches are taken. And remember that we had a win for this branch prediction if the number of branches that were taken was above 0%. So if it's 60, that's great. And this branch prediction, this very simple branch prediction, where we're just not wasting those two extra cycles, is going to improve our performance a surprising amount. So you might say, well, I don't do conditional jumps all the time. My processor is really about like doing math. But even so, it has a very big impact on performance. So let's say we have this instruction mix. We have 3% of our instructions are untaken jumps, 5% are taken jumps, 1% are returns, and 91% are other things. And for now, I'm going to assume that the other things take one cycle each, as far as throughput goes. We can do one per cycle. This means that we somehow dealt with data hazards. On Tuesday, we'll explain why this is closer to true than putting something like 4 or 3, like you might guess by assuming that we have to stall all the time for data hazards. So given this, we can compute sort of the number of cycles per instruction, which is a type of efficiency measure we'll commonly use for pipeline processors. And we can do this by saying, OK, 0.03 of our instructions are take 3 cycles because they're not taken jumps, 0.05 take 1 cycle because they're taken jumps, and so on. And we add those all up, and we get the average number of cycles that each instruction takes as far as throughput is concerned. So the latency is longer. This is the throughput of the processor in cycles per instruction overall. And we see that with only 8% of our instructions being jumps, our processor is about 10% faster with this branch prediction. So even though we don't even have sort of the best case for doing this branch prediction, that we have, you know, we're only saving 2 cycles, it's a big win for not much extra logic. In fact, arguably simpler logic. And we're doing very, very simple branch prediction. So you might hear about branch prediction and other things. So branch prediction is a big thing that real processors do. And it's more important than a real processor because their pipeline is not like 3 or 4 cycles long. Like, you know, ours is 5 long, so we have a 3 or 4 cycle wait. Theirs is like 5 to 15. And if saving 2 cycles is like a 10% win with not that many branches, you can imagine saving 10 is a pretty big win. And this is one of those big cases where by avoiding stalls or by worrying about stalls, this is a case where latency hurts pipeline performance. So branches in general, when we can't predict branches, when we have to do the stalling, when we don't have an alternative, this makes latency matter. And branch prediction is something which partially gets rid of that latency, but ultimately we care about the latency because how long we have to stall is how long does it take to figure out whether the branch is taken or not. In our case, how long we had to stall was the number of cycles until we got to the stage where we had the condition codes. And if you have a longer pipeline or higher latency to do that, that stall time is going to be worse. So this is a case where the latency actually hurts us. And as I said, modern processors do a lot of branch prediction.
because it really, really helps performance, and have also, because of the sort of stalling problem, gotten into trouble. You can't have the sort of full benefits of pipeline because you can't do this perfectly. So the Pentium 4 is a famous story. So Pentium 4 was an Intel processor in 2000. And at the time, Intel wanted to have really high clock rates, because people really liked high clock rates. They thought that was how fast their processor was. And if we think about our pipelining idea, we think that we get roughly one instruction every clock cycle. And when you're doing that, it makes sense. You want a higher clock rates, because that means you're doing more instructions. But because we can't always do branch prediction correctly, and we have to do these stalling to deal with things like branches and returns sometimes, even though Intel did a lot of work on their branch predictor, because of their work to have this higher clock rate, they had a very deep pipeline. It was like, it depends who, I've seen different numbers quoted, but something like 20 or 30 stages. So we have 5, they had like 30. Depends how you count. This gave them a higher clock rate, so a higher maximum throughput. But for real programs, they were really hurt because, you know, this branch prediction didn't always work, and they had this stalling, and they had this lower performance from the stalling. So here's a quote from the review for our first generation Pentium 4. "For today's buyer, the Pentium 4 simply doesn't make sense. It's slower than the competition in just about every area. And it's more expensive." So it was a big flop because they really bet on increasing their maximum throughput, but not really dealing with all these hazards in a good way. Yeah?
Did they not realize that, or was it more just like a marketing tactic?
So the question is, did they not realize that? So the Pentium 4 was faster on certain classes of programs. It was not faster on existing benchmarks. So I think they realized it. Part of the problem was that they didn't actually meet the clock rate targets they had. They had a 50% higher clock rate than their competitors. I think they wanted to have like 75 or 100% higher, but they didn't get there. Another thing is that their processor was good at certain types of programs. It would actually do faster. But for typical programs that people were benchmarking at the time, it wasn't. And it certainly had a higher theoretical maximum rate. Like, it could do more math per unit time, because it had a deeper pipeline. In the best case, it did one instruction per cycle, or actually probably more than one instruction per cycle using techniques we won't talk about. So for us, we're just going to implement this simple branch prediction. So the Pentium 4 had this problem because of their long pipeline, and therefore these long delays, even with branch prediction, when the branch prediction was wrong, and other things about delays from pipelining, like other data dependencies which had to be resolved by ultimately stalling, that they got into trouble. And there were much more advanced things they were doing, and still they got into trouble. So I'll talk about some better branch prediction techniques that we're not going to implement in this class. So we're just going to assume every branch is taken, which is really easy to implement. So you just do the calculation of the next instruction to run as if it's an unconditional jump, and you have some extra logic which fixes that in the memory stage of the jump instruction if it turns out to be wrong. So predicting branches as taken is one of the simplest good branch predictors, but there's another almost a simple one which is better. And that's to predict forward branches, that is branches to a higher address as taken, and as not taken, and backwards ones as taken. And the intuition here is, again, loops. We have two types of loops we talked about. So you have loops where we have a conditional jump at the end to the beginning. That's a backwards branch. That's usually taken, assuming we execute the loop more than once. We have loops with a conditional jump at the beginning to the end. That's a forwards branch. That's usually not taken, assuming we execute the loop more than once. And when you do something like this, I think the numbers I've heard are like 70 to 80% correct, maybe maybe much more in some programs for branch prediction. And this is really simple to implement. So this is sort of the next step up to adding what we could add to our processor easily to predict branches better.
So there's one big hole we had, which is ret. We're taking four cycles in ret, and we didn't fix that. And it turns out that real processors do branch prediction for returns. It's important enough, they want to make it work. And it seems pretty hard, because how do we even know where the return goes? We can't even make a guess. Do I just guess a random address? It wouldn't work. So what the processors do is they have an extra data structure. So you have the stack in memory with your save registers, your return addresses, and your return addresses. And the processors keep a copy of the return address part in the CPU. So when you make a call instruction, they add to this little stack in the CPU with the return address. And when you make a return instruction, they use this stack to make a prediction. Now, they might run out of room, right? Or you might put something on the stack without call and then return to it. They still need to handle that case correctly. And that's fine, because this is used for a prediction. And just like we did with the conditional jump, they're going to actually still run the return instruction and still read from the real stack. And they're going to see, hey, was the thing I read the thing I predicted? And if it's not, they're going to undo all the instructions that they ran based on the prediction and start the real code. But as long as when they're right, they've saved a lot of time. In our processor, that would be four cycles saved. Three cycles saved every time. Because you didn't have to wait to do that memory access. You would still do it, just in case. But usually you'll get it right. But it's okay if you run out of room and make a wrong prediction. That's fine. You're going to fix yourself. You're just going to be slow, or you're not going to be wrong. So any questions about this ret prediction? This is something that real processors do, so you can actually predict ret, even though it seems hard. You just need to keep a little extra data around. So we have this idea of branch prediction being that we look at an instruction, and then we use the information in that to predict the next instruction, based on looking at the instruction quickly. We can't look up data, but at least we can look at the instruction. Real branch prediction is more complicated. And I just want people to be aware that this is not what real branch prediction is, because real processors often take multiple cycles to read the instruction memory. And if you want to read an instruction every cycle, this means that you need to make predictions before you've read the instruction. So that's something that real processors try to do, in order to, in the best case, be able to do one instruction per cycle, even in a loop. And the way to do this is by having more data structures in the processor. We're not going to talk about what those look like, but I just like to let you know that it's not all about read the opcode to make a prediction. That sometimes they want to do things earlier than that. Okay, so that's what I have for today. So we took our normal processor and we talked about arranging it so we could add pipeline registers and figuring out what was in those pipeline registers. We talked a lot how about we compute the next instruction to run. So we have our normal case, and we had two special cases. For ret, we had the stall. We don't do any prediction, we just wait until we finish reading from memory, and then in the next cycle we actually execute the next instruction that ret tells us to run. And for conditional jumps, we could have stalled, but we have a better strategy, which is we guess that it goes to the taken place. It basically goes to the label in the jump instruction. And later on, we figure out if that's wrong and we squash the instructions we ran that we weren't supposed to. And that's easy to do because they haven't gotten far enough to change memory or registers. And in both these cases, these are things which are making our processor slower than our ideal throughput of one instruction per cycle. And so next time, after spring break, we're going to talk about how we deal with data hazards, and we're also going to talk about the stall and cancel logic for jump and return, how we actually implement that.